catch those springtime vibes all over Arizona. Break out of the winter blues by hitting the water at one of our lake and river parks. Take a hike among the wildflowers. Just make sure to stay on the trails and leave the flowers for the bees. Discover Arizona's best kept secret and visit azstateparks.com/amazing to start your springtime adventure.
It's lunchtime at Tim Hortons, and we're serving up a special deal just for you. Our new $5.99 lunch deal includes your choice of any lunch sandwich and a side of crunchy kettle chips. Because what's lunch without a little crunch? And the sandwich choice is all yours, like a ham and Swiss, Chipotle chicken wrap, BLT, and more, made to order just the way you like it. Tim Hortons' new lunch deal. Simple, delicious, and just $5.99. Now that's a good deal. Only at your neighborhood Tim's. U.S. only. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.
Welcome, dear listeners. I'm Jonathan Carlin.
And I'm Ben Carlin.
And we invite you to join us through the Gryffindor, your one-way ticket to the enchanting world of Harry Potter. So grab your wands and dust off your broomsticks and join us as we unlock the secrets behind Philosopher's Stone Chapter 2, The Vanishing Glass.
Wow. Top tier intro today.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
that
you.
That was really good. I feel like you have just been held back as nearly as all as I can tell.
I mean, yeah. I see you're repping the shirt from our other podcast where for somehow, I guess everyone thinks you're a better host over there.
Oh, I don't know anything about that. But what I do know about is chapter two of the Philosopher's Stone, aka Sorcerer's Stone, aka The Vanishing Glass.
Where do you land on Philosopher's Stone versus Sorcerer's Stone?
I will tell you that I went through a myriad of different emotions attached to this particular thing. So obviously, as an American, and the first copy of the book that I ever owned as a kid was Sorcerer's Stone. And one of my best friends at the time, for one reason or another, his family was extremely into like Premier League soccer and sort of like all things like England. And I know that he had a copy of the Philosopher's Stone, I believe before it had been released as the Sorcerer's Stone in America.
Wow, so probably has a pretty rare copy.
Well, this was like one of those things. So it was like a childhood friend who I had not known or had not spoken to, I think pretty much at all, just because we like moved in different directions in life starting from like age maybe like 10 or 11.
Yeah.
But like as we were like best friends starting from like day one of preschool and stuff like that. And once upon a time, we made a video over on the Super Carlin Brothers channel talking about like the most valuable copies of the Harry Potter books. And like what you're ultimately looking for is the first run. What is it? The ISBN number?
Inner cover there. I'd have to go back and look at all the specific ways in which you tell which run and which edition a book is, but you want first run, first edition UK.
Yes, exactly. And I, as we were like making that video and sort of like reviewing what those ISBN numbers were, I was like, goodness gracious, like this childhood friend very well might have like a very valuable copy of the book. And so like on a whim, I had like gone off to Facebook. I don't even know if we were friends on Facebook. And so like I found him, added him, and like immediately sent him a message. And I was like, hey, wild story, but like we're making this video. And I remember you had this book. And so I was like, is there any chance you know where it is? Could you like check the number? And like within 17 minutes of sending him that message, he had sent me a picture back of his numbers.
Whoa.
And I was like, I can't believe you had, like, not only did you go from accepting my friend request, reading my message, and then found the book, sent a picture of it, and returned it to me. So it wasn't like a first edition, edition.
But, bummer.
But it was like one of those points of contention, I think, because he read the UK edition. So
he had a shant book.
He had a shant book, yeah. And he referred to it as the Philosopher's Stone. And it was always one of those things very early on where it was like, okay, it's Sorcerer's Stone. All right. Like,
okay, you know, all right. Like,
so I think I had a chip on my shoulder for a really long time. And then we mentioned in the last episode about how we went to the British Library, the History of Magic exhibit, and sort of like delved really further deep into the history of the true blue, like, Philosopher's Stone throughout actual, you know, human history. And I think from that point on, I was always like, Philosopher's
Stone. Okay, Philosopher's Stone's like the real, like there is, like in history, there was a Philosopher's Stone people actually tried to make. The Sorcerer's Stone is a complete fabrication. It means nothing.
It means nothing. And, yeah. And largely what it comes down to is like, I believe that the publishers thought that American like buyers might be more open to the term sorcerer than philosopher. Like
yeah.
it seemed more magical to, I guess, or the perception at least was that was the yeah. case. I teeter back and forth though, because I never want to like, you know, gatekeep anybody or anything like that. You know, if you love the story, you love the story. That's all that matters.
Right.
I think I have started to adopt Philosopher's Stone as my primary.
I think so. Yeah. I remember growing up. Yeah. We just had Sorcerer's Stone. When I heard that, I think in history, the Philosopher's Stone will be remembered as a thing from Harry Potter more than it will be something remembered as like a real thing people tried to make.
Yeah, like
it's, which is silly.
In the field of alchemy, the Philosopher's Stone essentially is the end all be all.
It's like the point of alchemy.
It is the point of alchemy, yeah. is to achieve the Philosopher's Stone. So, yeah.
So there is that. So I think, yeah, similarly growing up though, I'd never heard of it at all. And so it was like Philosopher's Stone, Sorcerer's Stone. Obviously Sorcerer's Stone is better. And then, we have another friend in Europe who's like he used to do a lot of Harry Potter videos. His name is Seamus. And he came to visit us one time. And so then it was very fun to be like, oh no, the American version's better.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, of course. Yeah,
right, but then right. Same thing. We went to that British library thing and it was like, oh, it's absolutely Philosopher's Stone. And like since then, that's been like this is the correct version. But this is my recent update as of the last month. I personally am still a Philosopher's Stone. And I think when I adopted that, I was like, this is clearly the correct way to say it. Like, this is absolutely the right answer. And everyone knows it. I've been ignorant this whole time. And so that's what I've been saying since then. But we just did a video where we reviewed the covers of a bunch of different copies of Philosopher's Stone.
Yes. Oh, this is interesting.
Yeah, this is crazy. And so, because if you don't know, whatever copy of Harry Potter you have, there are, especially for Philosopher's Stone, there are the most versions of that cover. But there's like over 100 different official covers that you could have. And they range from like wild and wacky to like awe-inspiring and amazing. So if you want to check us out, like we go through, I think we've ranked over like 90 of them at this point.
Yeah.
Not ranked, but rated them or just reviewed them.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of like gave our two cents on how we felt about it. Yeah.
But so anyway, when we posted that video, I had to decide what I was going to call it. And it was a very obviously like, reacting to 50 different Philosopher's Stone covers. And I put Philosopher's Stone in the title and I put Philosopher's Stone in the thumbnail. And I was like, okay, didn't even think twice about it. But then as you go across all the other countries, America's the only one that listed a Sorcerer's Stone. All the other countries listed as a version, like their language's version of Philosopher's Stone.
Right. Yes.
So it even made sense in that regard. But I was like, you know what? Let me do like just a little, I'm going to run like a little A/B test here and see whether or not the click-through rate is higher if we change it to Sorcerer's Stone versus Philosopher's Stone. And like, it totally was.
It was way more effective.
Not just a little, like way more effective. And it was like, oh, this is hilarious. Like our viewing audience is clearly in America. And they recognize Sorcerer's Stone as the true title of Harry Potter.
Apparently, yeah.
Number one.
That's our statistic-based reason for why you may call it Sorcerer's Stone.
Yeah, so why if you see it listed that way. But anyway, I think even though the copy we're reading says Sorcerer's Stone on the front, and I have to say, I'll do you a quick cover artwork rating. This one's awesome. It is like a pencil drawing. It's got Harry, there's a big snake, there's Hedwig, there's goblins, there's Hagrid and the egg, there is McGonagall back there, lots of little there's even Quirrell. Oh, I just found him for the first time. That's crazy.
Oh, wow, yeah, I hadn't even spotted him either. Kind of like right underneath.
Oh, there's maybe even Voldemort right over Hedwig's head. This is a really cool copy, and I think there's a whole series on the inside cover there. So very cool one. Anyway, Ben, let's jump into chapter 2, The Vanishing Glass, where we are celebrating Dudley Dursley's first birthday. It starts out, this is actually, I'm going to start out right away at the really cool fun fact.
Okay, yeah, lay it on
us. Okay, so the first three words is just nearly 10 years had passed since the Dursleys had woken up to find their nephew on their front step. Okay. The phrase nearly 10 years immediately like reminded me of this amazing fact that is true, just true about Harry Potter. So, Harry's parents are attacked on October 1st, October 31st, 1981.
Correct.
Right?
Yes. Meaning that we are now, as of this chapter in June, I believe, of
it is
1991.
Right. So yeah, 1991. So it has been nearly 10 years. So Harry's birthday is on July 31st of 1991, which would be, that is not just 9 years later, but it is also 9 months later from the attack on his parents down to the day, because it's October 31st and July 31st.
Yes.
Meaning that it is exactly 9¾ years from the moment Harry leaves the Wizarding World to re-enters it.
It's incredible. It's incredible. So yeah, the nearly 10 years is such like a little like tip of the hat. It's like nearly.
Yeah. But then it's so great because it's platform 9¾, which literally takes him to the Wizarding World.
Yes.
It's just like, I love it. It's so, like, I don't know if that was accounted for or on purpose. It feels like no, because it's just like, because Halloween feels like a specific date and July 31st is the author's birthday as well.
Yes.
So
yes.
It's like that. Yeah. Those don't feel, it just feels like it worked out perfectly.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. Just, but it, I mean, it's amazing that it literally is coming down to actually the day itself.
Yeah.
But I guess technically at this point in time, that is upon, that is really the distance of time since, Hagrid himself has last seen.
Yes, it is the exact amount of time from Hagrid to Hagrid in Harry's life.
But it's so fun. I think that
that's a chapter ahead.
We're getting ahead of
ourselves here. This is the Vanishing Glass. It's Dudley's birthday right now, June 23rd.
Yes, indeed. And this chapter I think is really, it's kind of all about, I think, giving you a really strong sense of just how difficult this decade has been for Harry. Like, you're getting a really good feel. I mean, right away you learn that, like, you know, he sleeps in the cupboard underneath the stairs in that cupboard in a house that is otherwise described as like almost verging on like upsetting levels of immaculately clean.
it is weird how that's described. It's like, it is almost upsettingly clean in the house.
Yes. Yeah. I often think that this is like one of those things where it's like, it's like, cause I mean, I tend to feel like I keep my house pretty clean as well. And I'm always like, sometimes it's almost like, you know, like you're scrubbing your counters or something and you're like, should I lay off a little bit? Am I taking this too far?
Have I reached Petunia Dursley levels of cleanliness? I'm never concerned about that in my house.
No, me neither. No. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of course not.
Let me tell you what, my three boys, I could clean it and they'll come through, and 10 minutes later, it's like, why did I even bother? It's
right.
Just anyway.
Yeah. But either way, so despite this immaculately clean house, Harry sleeps in a cupboard underneath the stairs that is apparently absolutely just jam-packed full of spiders. Yeah,
the amount of times the spiders in the cupboard under the stairs are brought up is like, it's like, how could there be that many spiders if the rest of the house is so clean?
I know.
Are they just drawn to him? Is that like a magical thing?
Well, and this is what I find to be kind of interesting about this chapter in particular, is that you both learn about Harry's relationship with spiders and his relationship with snakes. And it seems like his relationship with snakes goes on to be massively important to his overall character altogether.
Yeah.
And his relationship with spiders is not nothing, but it's like, I do think it's interesting that like, it's a semi-prominent thing that he will interact with in his years to come, but not really important in any other way.
I mean, it isn't, I mean, it's fairly, I guess it's like, was this, was there a certain amount of consideration given to like, really establishing Harry as like, I'm not afraid of spiders, like, because later on, we're going to have to go into the forest and follow giant spiders. And like, even a regular person who's not like afraid of spiders still might not want to like follow spiders.
I suppose there's some possibility there. I think the other thing is, I mean, I don't know if like on some level, just Harry, you know, like he is a true blue Gryffindor at the end of the day. His, you know, his bravery is, you know, rather immense. Like, and spiders are a rather common thing for someone just to be fearful of in general. So
that's true. It's just like establishes some Gryffindoriness. This is, it's a, like, I got to the end of this chapter. I was like, man, this is like a, not a whole lot happens in this chapter. Like, there's not a lot of magic happening. Well, some magic happens, but there's no like, there's no other wizarding people at all. It's just Harry.
Well, this is, I mean, it kind of reminds me a little bit of like a season of like network TV shows, where very frequently what you would find is that like episode one would be jam packed with like sort of like get you like back into the action or introduce you to like a story and like all the juicy details. And then sort of there's like a taper off as the season like progresses. 'Cause usually usually network TV shows would go for like a 20 plus episode season.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of time to cover. It's a lot of screen time. So like you almost need to have these like otherwise side plots and stuff. And so this story is maybe no exception to that in some capacity, where like on some level you're just introduced to like Dumbledore and Hagrid and McGonagall and like the fall of Voldemort and like, you know, like all of this massive monumental stuff is happening. And then this chapter is a bit more like cooking bacon and going to the zoo.
Right. Like, it's like, let's reset. Like, we knew a lot of the stuff. Let's meet Harry, the 11-year-old, as he is now, before anything crazy has happened to him.
Yes.
What has happened in the last 10 years? Like, we're going to bridge a gap here. So that's a lot of what's happening here. I would say on the first page, a couple of things popped out to me. Like, first of all, I love that he had a dream about the flying motorcycle in it. It's just like, oh.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
A little heartwarming there.
It's a little heartwarming. And it's also like, I think that's a good setup for things to come, because Harry's dreams are not irrelevant to the story going forward. Like, you learn a lot about the wizarding world. The story progresses oftentimes thanks to Harry's dreams. And so this is kind of like a cool one where it's a little bit more positive than a lot of the dreams that Harry gets to have going forward, which tend to get a little bit darker.
Yeah. And then just right like a paragraph later, this is just something I noticed that we talked about last time. It's like some things are a little different once you're older, like you just might read past it or something. But like just when you realize like through the scope of time how close Dudley's birthday is to Harry's, like I think Dudley's is June 23rd and his is July 31st. And they're born in the same year.
Yeah.
So they're born age. Like within a month of each other.
Right.
Basically, which is just like, when I think about it, it's just like super duper sad for Lily and Petunia, because like they would have been pregnant at the same time and it's basically just not spoken to each other at all.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it makes you think, like, because the Dursleys say they never met Harry, which probably means that Lily and James died without ever having met their nephew.
Oh my gosh,
which is like also
sad. That is super sad. I never considered it through their lens looking the other way before.
Yeah.
And of course that is, I mean, you know, one of the grand sacrifices that I think James and Lily would have made at some point in time was living under the Fidelius charm, meant being stuck inside of your home, mm-hmm. you know, just with nobody to accompany you except for your immediate surroundings. I mean, and for people who are so used to, you know, sort of like adventure and being in the fray and being so involved as like, you know, sort of warriors in this cause, it's like, I mean, you could just imagine the level of kind of like stir crazy that would be involved. And then not to mention everything else you miss out on in the meantime.
Yeah. It's like, I like to think in my head that like eventually they would have tried to like reconcile with the Dursleys.
Oh,
like
sure.
If, you know, there's no war or whatever, like eventually they like try or at least get Harry to meet his cousin or something, but it's like, that never gets to happen.
I know. And I do think, it's always possible. I mean, I know that we've consumed it a million different ways. I know that there's a deleted scene in the films when the Dursleys are ultimately leaving where Petunia has a moment with Harry. And I'm pretty sure it doesn't happen in the books. It might just be a movie only moment.
I think so.
But it's something that I actually felt like the movies, even though they cut it out, it was a deleted scene. It was one of those rare occasions where I actually felt like they added something to the story that was really kind of nice, which is Petunia basically saying like, you know, you're not the only one who lost somebody that day, and essentially alluding to the reality of the fact that, you know, like despite the fact they've had a fraught relationship, Petunia lost her sister, mm-hmm. Who, you know, even if she had struggles and her insecurities and stuff that sort of like lead Petunia down the path that we ultimately know she goes down, it's not as though she didn't still love her sister underneath it all. And yeah, that's hard and complicated to unpack.
I think the closest you get to that in the books is just like Dumbledore sending that letter that says like, remember my last or something. And she's like, no, PS to stay.
Even though that's true.
Yeah. And it's like, that, but that's as close as you get in the book. So yeah, they cut that out of the movie. And then they also cut out the scene where Dudley tells Harry he's not a waste of space.
Oh yeah.
Which does happen in the book, and you can watch the deleted scene and it's awesome.
It's a great moment. It's like,
why didn't you leave this in? This was great.
I know. I have this feeling in such a big way about a lot of the characters and I'm sure we'll get to Draco a lot as well, but you know, with Dudley in particular, it's one of those things that were, especially as I've gotten older, as a kid, you know, I knew kids like Dudley and I mean, it was frustrating and you didn't want Dudley to win and all the rest. And, as you get older and you reflect a little bit on, you know, like sometimes as a kid, what are you supposed to do other than parrot your parents' beliefs? You know, it's like as an 11-year-old, it's like, you haven't really been given enough freedom in life to think independently from everything you've ever seen or you know, like experienced, which right. is your upbringing and views and perspectives of your parents. And interestingly, like one of the things that I, going into the next page here that I had written down was like, you know, the Dursleys go to such extreme lengths to spoil Dudley that at times I've been curious before, like had Harry not been in the home, like would they have spoiled him to this extent? Because it's so aggressive, it's so over the top.
I don't think so, because there are like several examples, even just in these first few chapters, where it's like they're going like out of their way, like putting extra effort on themselves to like make sure Harry is miserable.
Yes.
Like even the spiders, it's like the whole house is clean. Like clearly you care about it, but there's still spiders under the stairs.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, so sometimes I think like what they're really doing is not spoiling Dudley so much as trying to demonstrate their active neglect of Harry.
Right.
Like, yeah, look, we bought Harry or we bought Dudley, you know, when he gets to the zoo.
It's almost an oxymoron, active neglect. Cause it's like, it'd be better if you just neglected him.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. What that being said, one thing I have read about the Dursleys before is almost this idea that and this is the barest minimum, and I would barely even call it like an accolade, but they do not pretend to love Harry. So like, I don't think that, and maybe this is, again, I mean, it's hard to call it a gift, but like maybe this is like one of those things where it's like Harry doesn't have the wrong idea about what love looks like. He's just never experienced it prior, right. You know, throughout his entire lifetime with the Dursleys. So at least on some level, he's not led to believe like Rapunzel under Mother Gothel's care, you know, in Tangled or something.
Oh,
like,
right.
She thinks this is what love looks like. And it's like, that's just gaslighting.
That's just nope. Yeah.
So anyway, not to get too off brand here, but anyway, yeah, so the rest of this chapter has really like the entire journey to the zoo, a lot of sort of demonstrating how spoiled Dudley is. We, of course, have the whole like, you know, how many are there? 36, count them myself.
Yes.
And that's always been one of like the most quotable lines in my mind from the movies that has just simply ever existed. We have the very, very, very brief introduction to Pierce Polkus, who we spoke a little bit about in last week's episode, but who at one point in time you actually wrote a rap about.
Mm-hmm. I sure did.
Which was truly incredible, but basically it suggests that Peter Pettigrew had himself a son with sort of that like shared initial scheme with the Pierce Polkus, Peter Pettigrew.
It's not just that. It's that also he said he has a face like a rat.
Yes.
It's like in the same sentence. And it's like, well, face like a rat. Come on, with the same initial scheme right there. Pierce Polkus is also the one who's like, Harry was talking to the snake. Like he's the one. It's like a really subtle thing, but it's like in Pierce's mind, it is possible to talk to snakes.
Oh, sure. You know? Yeah.
It is like whereas like the rest of the muggles you meet, it's like they would, you just sort of know, like you can't talk to snakes, but in Pierce's mind, like maybe there's just enough like magic in there that it's like he thinks of talking to snakes as a thing that could happen.
Yes.
Like maybe he's probably a squib is really more what it is, but
very possible. But the other aspect of it there as well is like he's playing a kind of similar role with Dudley where he does come across as like, you know, Dudley's sort of like the big mean bully that I feel like everybody mm-hmm. sort of has to like bend to. And Peter Pettigrew's primary operative for pretty much everything, even his attraction to the Marauders in the first place, has to do with essentially looking for the biggest kid on the yard. And then obviously once Voldemort becomes the even bigger kid on the yard, he's just always a kind of a coward seeking the safety of that protection.
Yeah.
And in a way that seems like that's exactly what Pierce is.
It's exactly like that. So yeah, I stand by it. Pierce Polkus is the bastard child of Peter Pettigrew.
There you go. Yep.
There you go.
Indeed.
So there's a few things here, like as we're just introduced to Harry, the 11-year-old, and like what his relationship with Dudley is, that I just like, I marked and I thought were very like fun and interesting things that popped out as per the overall story. First is that it talks about how Dudley's favorite punching bag is Harry, but he can't often catch him because Harry didn't look up, but he's very fast. And it's like just sort of immediately setting you up for like Harry the Seeker later on.
Absolutely. Yep. And also in a way, Dudley the Boxer.
Dudley the Boxer, big D.
Big D. Yeah, so I do find it to be kind of interesting and funny that like almost right away, this idea of punching is sort of like ingrained into who Dudley is. So, I mean, he did show some early signs.
Yeah, there's no doubt. There's no doubt about it. Then Harry is immediately described as having the bright green eyes, which of course is one, a nod to his mother. He's always described as looking like his dad, but then having his mother's eyes. But then it's also really funny that like there's like this weird contrast where Voldemort ends up having red eyes and Harry has green eyes, and they're like the opposite colors of the houses they're in.
Yes, and, and additionally as well, the Avada Kedavra curse is green, whereas Expelliarmus is red.
Or at least in the movies.
I think it's described as red sparks, but I can't remember specifically. But
Avada Kedavra is always green.
Green. So the kind of yin and yang effect that appears to be going on, sort of like with that red and green, you know, sort of speaks to the duality. Actually, and it could even set us up for one of the kind of fun theories you could examine that I don't necessarily think you would subscribe to, actually, but is the general sentiment that in some way, because Harry has a piece of Voldemort's soul inside of him, that he is in fact a Horcrux, and therefore the mistreatment of him at the hand of the Dursleys is much more a la Ron wearing Slytherin's locket in, you know, Deathly Hallows and like the presence. But this is it's kind of one of those where it's like the Dursleys make it pretty clear pretty early before Harry's even there that this is not their kind of people. Yeah. They are not for it. We also know that Petunia has a very strong history with her sister. Like, her own sense of insecurity is what's driving a lot of her hatred towards Harry.
Yeah.
And it's also, it's kind of like one of those theories where, like, when you first hear it, you're like, oh, that's interesting. And then it's also like, it kind of feels like you're victim blaming
you're like making excuses for the Dursleys, and it's like,
you don't need to make excuses for the Dursleys. You need to
make excuses for the Dursleys right there. They also talk about how like they keep cutting Harry's hair because it's always like so messy, but it makes no difference. His hair always grows back.
Yep.
And it always grows that way. And I think that's really funny. It's like that his hair doesn't just always grow back, it always grows back messy.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is like there's a certain like overall, as you continue to experience more and more of the wizarding world, there's this like underlying messaging that like, you know, a little bit of rule breaking, like magic is just sort of like messy by nature. Like if you're really into magic and you're doing magic right, it's like a little bit messy and it's a little rule breaky and it's a little like not perfect and ordered. It's a little jumbled and stuff. And I think like, it's like, yeah, the magic could just fix Harry's hair, but it's like, it is not just out of place. It's like magically out of place.
Absolutely. And I think it's funny too, because I mean, you eventually do learn that like a huge reason why Harry has such an inheritance from his family has something that stems directly back to his like genetic predisposition to have this particularly messy hair.
Yes,
the sleek easy hair potion. Yeah. It's a little bit of additional reading outside of the universe, but you do eventually learn that the inventor of that is one of Harry's forefathers, and that's why
he's so rich.
That's where the family wealth comes from.
And yet Harry does not ever apparently use the potion.
He doesn't seem to whatsoever. No. Yeah, it has no knowledge whatsoever that this is something you would have a relationship with.
Also, Harry describes Dudley as looking like a pig in a wig, which I just think is funny because Ron eventually goes on to own an owl named Pigwidgeon, which is like Pigwidgeon, pig in a wig. And it's like, did Harry give Pigwidgeon the name? Is this like a very subtle, like low-key stab at Dudley from like years later where like he's comparing giant Dudley to the tiny like tennis ball owl that is Pigwidgeon? Because Harry also uses wig in his own owl's name.
That's true.
Pigwidgeon, Hedwig, pig in a wig. I don't know. Maybe there's something there.
No, yeah, I got you. I mean, it seems like Pigwidgeon and Dudley are about as far apart from one another as they possibly could be.
Absolutely, they are.
But I never noticed the fact that there's wig in both Hedwig and Pigwidgeon's name before. That's pretty funny. One of the other details that I highlighted in this particular chapter is the fact that we get the introduction to the infamous or famous, just in that sense, round glasses that Harry wears.
Oh, yeah.
This is always one of those things. So we, of course, know that Harry is pretty aggressively mistreated by the Dursleys, but there is always one of those like at some point in time they had to take him to the eye doctor,
right?
You know, and almost and certainly they did. Yeah, and they did, and so like I've even thought before, like, you know, as time has gone on, you know, like probably even had to go more than once. Like even after Harry started like attending Hogwarts, it feels like at some point over the summer he probably needed to like go back and have his eyes checked again. Like surely he from age 11 till 17, he's not wearing the same pair of glasses.
Oh, right. Like he probably needs a bigger pair at some point.
At some point.
Yeah. You're right. Do you think he's doing it over the summer?
Right. Yeah. It's like, maybe it's like he has to go back to the Dursleys for, you know, of course, the ancient magic protection that keeps him safe there and new glasses.
Yeah. And to visit the actual Muggle eye doctor.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. That's in there as well.
Through the Gryffindor is supported by Pear Eyewear. Y'all, I am so excited for our upcoming Through the Gryffin tour. It is going to be such a good time, but as ever, when you're going to be spending time in front of people, you want to be looking your darned best. And let me tell you what, Pear Eyewear has arrived just in the nick of time. Like, honestly, I was immediately blown away with my new frame. So let me walk you through exactly what they do. So starting at just $60, including your prescription, you can get your base frames, which are like sleek, modern, and stylish. But that is really just the start, because from there, you get to fully customize each frame, all of your looks, by simply snapping on the top frames. And they actually have an entire collection of Harry Potter frames. So like for the upcoming tour, I was so pumped. I was like, oh my gosh, I've got to find some super cool Slytherin frames that I can like wear. But then as I was clicking around, I've been watching X-Men 97, which is like so good. And they actually had X-Men frames as well. And then May the 4th is coming up, or maybe by the time you're listening, it's already passed. But like they have a huge collection of over 20 Star Wars frames as well. So I had a very hard time narrowing, and I ended up getting two. I got the X-Men ones and I got some Slytherin ones. So many different like fandom frames you can choose from. And I never thought to accessorize my glasses with fandom stuff, but now you can. And it's so easy to change between them. Like they have little magnets on them, so you can just slap a different frame onto the front of your glasses and then easily switch it out. I've been doing it all day. It's so fun. And before you commit to anything, you can explore all the different possibilities with their virtual try-on. But again, the base frames for men, women, or kids. I think honestly kids would love this because you can just switch them out and they're so fun looking. They all start at $60. One pair, infinite possibilities. Go to PairEyewear.com and use code GRIFFIN for 15% off your first pair, and support the show by mentioning that Through the Gryffindor sent you in your post-checkout survey. That's PairEyewear.com, code GRIFFIN.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Let's see. We get introduced sort of to Aunt Marge here. Like she's referenced in the last one, and this time she's given a name as someone who gave it Dudley. It's crazy how quickly she's introduced, and like she just feels like an off-page character, and then she actually shows up in Prisoner of Azkaban to be the worst.
Yes, she is. I mean, I think Aunt Marge is right up there with eventually Dolores Umbridge.
Comparable.
Just like a truly terrible person, but like we've said this on so many occasions before, but like, you know, Voldemort is evil in this sort of like storybook evil sense, you know, but then like Umbridge is a teacher you've just had before.
Yeah.
Aunt Marge is just a disapproving relative you've had. Like these are just mean, like this is not like an otherworldly, it's not a magical kind of evil. This is like a down to earth, real, like kind of person you might just
encounter
like almost inevitably. It is interesting again because, you know, we get Sirius Black in chapter one, Aunt Marge in chapter two, and both of those characters are very prominent in the beginning of Prisoner of Azkaban. You know, two books ahead.
Let's see. We also get Mrs. Fig introduced here, and this is interesting. It says, bad news, Vernon, she said Mrs. Fig's broken her leg. And it's like, and then there's later down in the paragraph, it says, now what, said Opportunia, looking furiously at Harry as though he'd planned this. And I'm always like, this is one of those, like, now, obviously, Harry didn't do anything to Mrs. Fig, but we know that Mrs. Fig is a member of the Order of the Phoenix and a squib who lives across the street. And it's like, did Dumbledore plan this? Like, did Dumbledore want this to happen? Because this is like one of those, like, Dumbledore's big plan. Like, Dumbledore knows about the prophecy, like, since before the attack on the Potters.
Yeah.
And, like, he already knows Harry's going to have to be the one. So it's like, he begins pulling the strings on Harry's life, like, way earlier than you might realize. And it's like, did Dumbledore like want Harry to go to the zoo because he knew that Harry would then see a snake, and like, was, did he have some idea? Like, is there any of that happening here?
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, book one in particular has a lot of signs that suggest that what Dumbledore is truly doing the whole time is trying to guide Harry and give him the necessary ingredients. And even, you know, Harry will eventually say in like, you know, towards the end of the story, but like that he feels as though Dumbledore like thought that he deserved a go at Voldemort if he so desired. And then of course, all the obstacles that are in the way are all things that Harry happened to learn that year. You know,
which, yeah. Like look at these challenges set up perfectly for Harry, Ron and Hermione. What are the odds?
Right,
oh my God. Here's the real giveaway that Mrs. Fig's leg breaking, quote unquote, isn't real or is staged or not real. Okay. Right. Because Mrs. Fig is genuinely a part of the Order of the Phoenix and she knows Dumbledore and she lives where she lives because Harry lives there.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Very intentionally.
Yep. The cats she raises, this is like a little more like out of extra universe reading, but they're actually half Neasel. So she's actually breeding magical creatures.
Yep.
But here's the thing. There's no reason for her to have a lengthy broken leg. Right.
This is a solvable thing.
Unless if you were in the magical world, this should be solved like that.
Right. Yeah. We know Madame Pomfrey is capable of mending a bone overnight.
In like seconds.
Okay. Sure. Yeah. In seconds. Because you can regrow bones overnight.
Bones overnight. Yeah.
That's a good point. So the interesting question here is whether or not magical potions would work on someone who is of the blood status of Mrs. Fig, which is a squib, because one of the things that her house is, that Harry says her house smells like is cabbage, which is a smell that is also associated with Polyjuice potion.
Oh, is it?
It is. Yes. Cabbages. And so that's like one of those interesting ones where it's like, it's almost curious or you almost wonder like, is there a chance that there is like a brew of Polyjuice potion inside of Mrs. Fig's house all the time? Because we eventually learn that Mrs. Fig like has to make Harry stays over at her house uncomfortable because otherwise the Dursleys never would like let Harry go and stay there.
Yeah, if he
there.
Thought he was enjoying it, yeah.
Right, so it's like Mrs. Fig is like, I understand I made it miserable for you, like, and I'm sorry about that. Like this was like part of like what I had to do. Mm-hmm. But it does make you wonder, like, is anything that's ever happening, like, is Mrs. Fig's like job, like, to basically like go and monitor and watch, you know, Harry. At all times, mm-hmm. like, you know, and like maybe that cabbage smell is just a big pot of Polyjuice that's always
that'd be hilarious,
always on.
But
brew.
Like even that. It is curious whether or not potions would work on muggles, but actually I think they would because the idea, at least Dumbledore's theory, whether or not he's correct in his theory, is that Merope Gaunt uses a love potion on Tom Riddle.
Wow. That's a good point.
Yeah.
And realistically, even eventually Fred and George's, I mean, it's not a potion, but it's still a magical creation. The Tun-Tun Toffee works on Dudley. So
that's true. So it feels like that would work, but either way, a broken leg would be just a spell. It wouldn't even be a potion.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah. Like this is like a for a wizard, especially where teleportation is not beyond the realm of possibility. It's like Mrs. Fig could just write to Dumbledore and be like, hey, I had a bit of a malady.
And it's like, and it's not like, oh, this happened this morning. And so Dumbledore or someone hasn't gotten there to fix it yet. It's like there's days later when he goes to visit her and her leg's still broken. So it's like, either she's faking it or it's allowed to be broken for an amount of time, like when it does not need to be.
Well, and anyway, so the more important aspect of this is we know that Dumbledore is known for having some good guesses. And on some level, I don't think it's a reach to suggest that we know that Harry's trip to the zoo ends up being very important, very relevant, you know, to his journey. And we basically learn about a very specific ability, which is his ability to speak to snakes in this moment. So it doesn't feel like a reach to me to think that Dumbledore just simply arranged this, or it was just simply a lie and like she's just wearing a fake cast or something
You
know, like she just didn't actually break her leg.
Because there's another thing in here. I think later it says like, oh, ever since she broke her leg, she wasn't very fond of her cats anymore. And it's like, that's not true because one, like they're part of what she's like, that's her job. She breeds the Neasels.
Right.
So it's like, I don't think there's a situation where she's less fond of them ever. So anyway, yeah, I think the whole Mrs. Figgs has a broken leg thing is a huge farce by Dumbledore to get Harry to the zoo. Maybe not because, maybe just to even see, maybe Dumbledore has like an idea that like, I need to see what happens when Harry is near a snake. And we're going to make that happen.
We're going to make that happen.
Yeah. So let's see. Oh, this is a funny one too. Another thing they try to do is they try to, send Harry to Petunia's friend, Yvonne, as someone who could watch him. So he doesn't have to come to the zoo because God forbid
right.
that he come, but she can't, Yvonne can't watch him because she's on vacation in Majorca, which I just think is hilarious because literally in the next book, when Uncle Vernon is trying to close his deal with Mr. Mason, his plan is to close the deal and then buy a vacation home in Majorca.
So it's
Majorca. Is that what is it?
In
is
Majorca.
It
Majorca.
Oh my gosh. I'm saying it so wrong.
I think it's okay. Yeah.
Jim Dale says it as Majorca.
Does he really?
I think so.
Okay. Okay. That's well, then maybe it has double pronunciation, but I think Majorca. It's in Spain and it's a soft J.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. Majorca then. And I just think it's really funny that it comes up twice and that it's like clear to me that like in my mind, there is no doubt that the reason the Dursleys want a vacation home in this spot specifically is because Petunia's friend Yvonne has one. And it's like one of those like, oh, this is a real one-upsmanship by them. It feels like. Yeah. They're like, you have a vacation home in Majorca? Well, guess what? Move over.
We're getting
one and it's also going to have a pizza oven. So
you know, keeping up with the Joneses. That's right.
Keeping up with the Yvonne's.
No, so, that's hilarious. Anyway, although I literally highlighted Yvonne's name and just wrote trivia and was like, this is like one of those questions where if it came up and it was sort of like, can you name Petunia's friend who is on vacation in Majorca and therefore cannot watch Harry? I'd be like, nope.
Well, now we can. Now we know the real reason they want a vacation home there is because Yvonne does.
Because Yvonne. Yep. There we go. Okay.
There so we go.
Let's see here. The next big thing. We've got, let's see, the eventual trip to the zoo.
Yep.
And I think one of the things I wrote down was the sheer volume of ice cream that Dudley consumes on their trip.
Like, does he?
You have two paragraphs that are back to back where it says the Dursleys bought Dudley and Pierce large chocolate ice creams at the entrance.
You're right, yep.
And then literally the next paragraph, it says Dudley had a tantrum because his Knickerbocker Glory didn't have enough ice cream on top. Uncle Vernon bought him another one. it's like in two paragraphs, okay. He's had three different servings of ice cream.
I know. Okay. I also looked up a Knickerbocker Glory. Did you look up what it is?
I absolutely did.
Yeah. Absolutely did. Yeah. It's huge. It is a big British Sunday.
It is. Yes. So, but this is one of those things. And I think like so often it's very interesting because we've asked the question a million times, but like, you know, is it British or wizarding? And this is like one of those things where like on my first pass of the story, Knickerbocker Glory would mean literally nothing to me at all.
Oh, I know.
I would have no idea what that was.
Yeah.
But I mean, you of course have the context, like one like word later, that's like, it didn't have enough ice cream on top. So it's like, okay, clearly it's a dessert of some kind.
It didn't have enough. That's funny too, because all the pictures I look like it was nothing but just a giant glass thing full of ice cream. So it's like, apparently this one didn't have enough. So get another one.
Right. It's like my giant flute of ice cream didn't have enough ice cream in it. So we got another one full of ice cream.
Well, yeah. Like, okay. I guess Harry really lucks out though, because he gets a lemon pop and at least what remained of the first Knickerbocker Glory. So great day for Harry all around.
Yep. Yep.
At least there. But then we move to the reptile house where I think it's very on purpose that like the snake is just sitting there. It can't move. It's trapped in the stage and like Uncle Vernon's rapping on it and it's just people bothering him. It's like the exact same as Aunt Petunia bothering him under the stairs.
Oh, it's the exact same. I think the chapter literally begins with Aunt Petunia like banging on she's just banging on the door.
Yeah.
You know, as he's trying to get up anyway.
Yeah. So, it's just like, there's a very obvious, definite intended parallel between Harry and the snake.
Yes.
And it's like, it's not just that he can talk to him, it's that he like relates to the snake.
Yes. Yeah. Yep, absolutely. Which even that is sort of interesting in a lot of ways, because like his you know, snakes in the story feel like they live on the other side of the diagram, so to speak.
Yeah.
Like more commonly associated with Slytherin, which is more commonly associated with like negativity or dark magic or evil. But in this particular case, it's like Harry is using an ability that he has baked into himself thanks to the piece of Voldemort that lives inside of himself.
Yeah.
I mean, that is the only reason that he's able to communicate with snakes in the first place. But in this capacity, it's like he's like seeing more of Harry's own true self, not the part of Voldemort.
Yeah,
inside.
You're
of him.
Right. It is interesting because the snakes that Harry interacts with the most via his ability to speak to snakes are the basilisk and Nagini,
yes,
which are like magical snakes. And you can easily forget that, like, oh, maybe it's like it can feel like Harry can just talk to like magical snakes, or that snakes are inherently magical or something. But it's like Harry can talk to any snake, and any snake would, this is what I noticed this time reading through it on the hardback, is that Harry's just staring at it, and the snake suddenly opened its eyes slowly, very slowly. It raised its head until its eyes were on level with Harry. It winked, which is like, at this point, Harry has said nothing to the snake at all. He's just looking at it. So there's like an aura almost being given off by Harry. The snake can immediately tell this person can talk to me.
Yes.
It's like, it suggests that like all snakes, even a snake bred in captivity, is aware of magic or something.
Which is weird.
It's
pretty fascinating. It really is. And I you know, I think to borrow a line from Name of the Wind, I think that there's like a, like being truly alone, like even being in a room with like an unconscious person or something is different from being truly alone. And I feel like this is like, or maybe even like that sensation you might get, like where you know that somebody is watching you.
Right.
It's almost like it feels like the snake is like encountered like this sensation of some kind. It's like, wait a second. Like, someone,
wait a minute.
Yeah, someone near me can communicate with me. It's like someone like-minded or something. I don't even know. But you're right. That is a very interesting one. And I caught that as well, as I was like, it's so fascinating that like it actually seems to be of its own accord, just simply kind of like reacting to Harry's own presence. So.
Right. Like, yeah, Harry just being there alerts the snake. That's really interesting. And surprising, snakes haven't like sought him out in any capacity before now, almost.
And again, you can go back to the little thing about the spiders there. Like this, like you're getting a lot of backstory about like little weird, like unusual happenings that Harry has gone through, mm-hmm. Throughout some of his life. And these are things that we know again from like further reading in the wizarding world, that like as young wizards are growing up, they are basically able to like their emotions effectively can create magical effects because they are like sort of inadvertently like directing their magic at something. And so we get a bunch of those examples, like where he gets like stuck on top of the chimney.
Oh, yeah, or where he apparates.
Yeah, he essentially has to apparate.
I know, I love that. I'm like, oh, Harry just low-key apparates right here. He's just like up on top of the school and he's like, the wind must have caught me. And it's like, come on, Harry.
I literally wrote, okay, I highlighted, Harry supposed that the wind must have caught him in mid-jump, and I wrote, LOL, no.
Apparate? Sorry.
Question mark? I know. But yeah, but anyway, I feel like you're right. Like it would have made sense instead of having like the spider situation, like to have like regaled us with stories of like, you know, at one point in time, Harry was punished because a group of snakes scared off a bunch of kids at the playground. Like it would have seemed like such an obvious like thing, but maybe it would have been too on the nose,
too obvious.
Like with what's to come anyway. But it wouldn't even surprise me if like without it ever being mentioned, without us even knowing if it's canon, in my mind, it's like that probably happened.
Yeah. You know what? Like the snake, they were out there, they were finding him. They could tell.
If anything, I would count that as a more likely reason that Harry otherwise seemingly had no friends whatsoever at school, because it says like nobody would be friends with Harry because like nobody wanted to go against Dudley. And it's like, I'm sorry, but like kids do not have that kind of beholdence to the class bully.
Oh yeah. Like it's there's like, no chance.
Yeah. Someone was kind enough to be Harry's friend.
Yeah.
You know, and, but like, you know, I mean, if he's summoning snakes everywhere. Yeah.
It's not Dudley, Harry. It's the snakes, it's bro.
It's like, you got to chill with the
but
snakes.
But I guess Harry never realized the snakes were there or something. I don't know.
Maybe not. The other thing about the snake that we can bring up, because I know this is like one of those very common fan theories that I think was like a meme somewhere along the way that caught a huge head of steam, is basically just that the boa constrictor character that Harry talks to at the zoo in during this particular scene, eventually goes on to become the snake Nagini. This is just something that we know for a variety of reasons to just be inaccurate. I don't think that Nagini is a breed of snake that can be named. It's just sort of like a magical snake, which we of course know comes from Nagini being a malediction, which is basically a human who has a curse that's or blood curse, right?
Blood curse,
That slowly transforms them from human to creature.
Yep.
We never get the full story as to why Nagini eventually goes on to support Voldemort in the future, but we know that at one point in time, Nagini was in fact a human person, and this snake was born
captive. It's also heading to Brazil. So
yes.
Yeah. So unless it takes a hard left into Albania to find Voldemort, which obviously it doesn't. I want to say this. Does it say the snake is male at any point? I don't know if it does.
Yeah, I don't know that it does either.
Doesn't matter. Okay, it's not that snake. So if you've been under the illusion that this snake that Harry sets free goes on to be Nagini, it is not. So that's sort of what happens at the zoo. Oh, he makes the glass disappear, which is really funny. I think it's like all these crazy things keep happening. They can't find where the glass broke. Oh my gosh, what happened? So Harry does a little bit of magic, but then the last page of the chapter here has him talking about how whenever they're out, like strangers seem to recognize him, like people in violet top hats and in emerald robes and purple. I noticed in the first couple of chapters, whenever the Dursleys or Harry see witches and wizards on the street in the wild, they're almost always wearing purple or green, which is just like random. I don't know if those just seem like the most non-muggle colors or something.
That is very interesting. I mean, this is like one of those things where very, very, very little to go off of, but the bald man in the very long purple coat does seem to fit Kingsley Shacklebolt, at least on the basis of how he's dressed, which is, it just kind of makes me happy to think that like Kingsley may have like also been like watching out for him. Cause Kingsley's always had that, like that air of like goodness, confidence, is very capable. So it's like just the idea on some level that like Kingsley would ever be like watching like over Harry from afar and even like take a moment to go over and like shake his hand and just like, you know,
yo, what's up?
Yeah,
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, because he walks away without a word, and even that seems like very, very Kingsley.
It does.
Just like walk up, like shake your hand.
I know. It also talks about how every time he meets someone, they seem to vanish, which is also interesting. Like everyone who meets Harry is like, "All right, time to go."
Pop,
and it's like that. Like early on, apparition seems like it was like a lot quieter. Like it's always described with like a pop or a snap later on. And it's like early, but whenever like when Dumbledore arrives, it just sort of appeared out of nowhere. There's never like a pop or a snap. Or all these people are like apparently meeting him and then exiting without like the loud crack sound. It's just like the and we're gone.
You know, this is one of those things that I would say that like I can never really get a firm grasp on, like throughout the story, like when it says like there's a crack associated with it, I can never really figure out like because I feel like sometimes it's like a car backfired, and it's like if it's cracking like a car backfires every single time, it's like that is a very, very, very noticeable noise.
Yeah, like you're right. Sometimes it is almost like it's so loud, like when Dobby does it outside of the window, it's like, yeah, it's like a car backfiring. But then other times it seems it's more like just like a snap sound or something.
I wonder if it has to do at all like with the brand of magic that's being used, or like the like how capable the wizard in question is or something. We'll have to keep our eye to the ground to see if there's like any you know, consistency whatsoever. Cause eventually we'll see in like Order of the Phoenix that like Fred and George are apparating like into the room, and surely that's the kind of thing that like, you know, if Molly was hearing them like crack from one level to another, she'd be like,
yeah, no good.
Yeah. She would say something about it.
Yeah, she would say something about it, but it does seem like they would be the kind of apparators who would like really try and have a loud crack.
Boom! It's like, I am here.
I think if I had to guess, this would be my reasoning, is that even though it accomplishes the same thing, house elves apparating versus wizards apparating is like actually subtly different magic, because like the house elves are able to apparate inside of Hogwarts even though wizards can't. So it must be a little bit like whatever blocks wizards from doing it doesn't block house elves. So it must be different. So I think maybe it is described that maybe just the house elves are really loud, whereas the wizards are more of like a bop.
Maybe that could be the case. Yeah, certainly. I mean, there's also Malfoy Manor. We'll eventually know that, you know, other adult wizards are incapable of apparating in or out of the basement, but Dobby is, is able to get in there as well.
Like, so, whatever, don't care. I used to live here.
You could, I wonder, I mean, speaking to like the subtlety of the magic, I mean, again, I think it's probably different brands altogether, but, you know, Dobby is using like wandless magic altogether, which I suppose there's some possible argument to be made, like that a wand helps you direct your energy more specifically, or like maybe it's like a more refined version of the spell.
Yeah.
And so maybe like it's more raw.
When
Dobby's doing it. But like, we also know eventually that house elves are incredibly powerful of their own accord. So,
yeah.
You know, that would certainly track. But anyway, so I mean, I think chapter two is sort of interesting. I mean, on the whole, I would say my key takeaways from it was largely to give you, while I always recollect in the first book that Harry's time spent with the Dursleys is a long time, it feels like this chapter is really covering a lot of the bases to kind of give you the idea of what his treatment was like while he's there.
You know,
like the fact that he lives in the cupboard, the fact that it's even common for them to like lock him in the cupboard for stretches of time.
I think at one point it says a week. And I want to say in the next chapter, there's one where it's like a month or something.
Right. And this is like one of those things where it's like, I don't like when you say trapped in there for a week. I mean, like, does that mean that the door is locked and you can't exit? Or is that being like grounded in your room? And it's like, okay, you need to go and spend like when you're at home, you're in your room.
Okay. Yeah. Not to get too far ahead. Just as the first page of the next chapter, it says by the this is for the Vanishing Glass situation. It says by the time he was allowed out of his cupboard again, the summer holidays had started, which so for reference, again, Dudley's birthday is June 23rd, right? And I was looking up when do summer holidays start and school end in like UK, and it's mid-July, which also tracks for like how close the next chapter is to like Harry's birthday, which is at the end of July.
July 31st.
So it's like if he was in there from June 23rd till mid-July, one, that is absolute crazy levels of abuse.
Oh yes.
Like
yes.
Just nonsense. Like that is horrible. Like there's Harry should be so much more messed up.
Oh yes. No, I mean the fact that he comes out the other side, you know, like I mean, I don't know. It's just, I mean, he's been through a lot.
It is
not a good life.
It also means like in some capacity, he was just kept out of school for like almost a month, basically. Like it seems like the Dursley should have been called out on that. It makes like, maybe he was at least going to school and it was like, as soon as he got home, he's there's no at least there. I'm sorry. it's just all bad. It's not, none of it's okay. It's so bad.
I know. It's like, you want it to just be like hyperbole or something. You want it to just be like,
but it's like you like, want it to be, but like, that's what it says.
I know, on the page. I know. It's like, well, that's not great. So, anyway, So difficult life.
Difficult life for Harry coming up on his 11th birthday here. Ben, what did you think of the chapter art for The Vanishing Glass?
Goodness gracious. I mean, it infuriates me to look at it a little bit. I mean, you know, he just like, Dudley just does have that look in the chapter art here. So if you can imagine, you got little Dudders there surrounded by a pile of presents, but really it's not the presents or anything else, that it's just the expression on his face, which just is, it is such an air of superiority.
It is. It's like, I deserve all these things.
Like even as they're describing what his particular like batch of gifts happens to be, like there's the inclusion of like a racing bike, you know, like a second television, and you know, it's funny because it's like I'm sort of just like imagining the most like comical, like from How the Grinch Stole Christmas pile of gifts you could ever imagine, and it almost seems like that's almost exactly what it is. It's like some of these things are just useless to him. It's an impressive looking pile of gifts.
Yeah,
so it's like, is he going to use a racing bike? It's like probably not, but like it makes the presentation of the gifts seem that much more extravagant. But the other funny thing about it too, as well, is we get a further breakdown of what the rest of his gifts happen to be. And I always think it's funny because it's like as they're given the rundown, it's sort of like, let's see here, the racing bike, the video camera, remote control airplane, and then it goes, so it's like really specific stuff, and then it's 16 new computer games and a VCR.
Yeah.
it's like, okay, we can't give a list of everything. So a bunch of games.
Yeah. A bunch of games. I want to say, is this the chapter that mentions a PlayStation?
I don't think this is the one that mentions the PlayStation. I think it's a reminiscence at some point in time, but it is an anachronism, I know, in the story where the PlayStation had not been... Whenever it's referenced, the PlayStation had not actually been released, attached to this time frame yet. Which, this is something we haven't really talked about before, and I will say, when I was reading the stories for the first time, kept baffling me a little bit, was I think, what would it be, in 1997 when the first book was released?
Yeah.
I think in my mind, it sometimes blew my mind, because I was close-ish in age to Harry as I was reading each of the installments.
Yeah.
So we were kind of progressing it.
It's
happening in the past. So I think one of the things that did throw me, very rarely and occasionally did this ever actually have like plot relevance, but you know, the fact that you get to the end of Harry's saga and it's only 1998.
Yeah.
I think by the end of the story, similarly, because like, I think my science fair project, for example, when I was in seventh grade, I made the Mailbox 2000, which was a mailbox that had like a sliding drawer so that you could like reach the mailbox from your car easier.
Yeah.
Without having to like reach so far in there. But like, I 100% stole the name from the Nimbus 2000.
Oh, that's so funny.
You know, and it's
The Nimbus 2000 shouldn't be called that.
Right. But like at the time of reading about the Nimbus 2000, like the year 2000 was upon us. Like the number 2000 felt very prominent for one very obvious reason.
Exactly.
But for Harry, it's like 9 years away.
Right. Yeah. Like, yeah.
We end the whole saga and it's still not the year 2000.
It's still not the year 2000. Yeah. So it's like, there's no reason it should be called the Nimbus 2000.
Yeah.
Just at all. Although, and they go on to do the 2001. Was there the Nimbus 1999? Like, I doubt it.
Right. No, absolutely not.
Is this actually model number 2000?
What are your thoughts on the chapter art?
Oh, I think, I mean, it's such an annoying looking little kid. It's like, I feel like he just looks so spoiled.
Just smug.
He's just so smug, so spoiled. So like, this isn't enough, even though I'm surrounded. I think his haircut, it's like, that is how it's described, but I always think of Dudley as how he's presented in the movies, which is different. Like, he's got brown hair in the movies and he definitely has blonde hair in the books, but yeah, it's just like, you get the idea that this is not a likable child. So yeah, it's pretty solid. It's pretty solid.
There we go. Okay. Well, so I think we're at a great point for chapter two. I feel like we covered a lot of bases, kind of a building chapter, I feel like, but yeah. I'm excited for
chapter three. Is a big one.
Chapter three, the letters from no one.
The letters from no one, except idea.
I absolutely love this upcoming chapter, so I'm very excited to delve into it and to break it down together and sort of go through all the bits as Harry starts getting his letters to Hogwarts, the thing that all of us wished as kids that someday, we always just assumed they were lost in the mail.
I know, right? Maybe one day. Part of me is always like, maybe, what if you don't find out you're a wizard until you're like 40, you know?
It's like
maybe in the book it's like 11, but like in real life, you know, they want grown adults who are like mature, who have some experience before they start handing out magic to people.
Exactly.
Okay? You know what I mean? Yeah, right. Yeah, come on now.
Yeah. So anyway, there's still hope is what you're trying to say.
Exactly.
I'll try not to put you on the spot here, but I do see that you're pulling something up on your phone. Is there a chance that you can grace us with a few verses from?
Yeah, I was thinking maybe I was pulling up the Peter Pettigrew rap here so I can, I'm not going to do the whole thing. Obviously, if you want to see the whole thing, you can look it up on YouTube. But I can, I'll give you the my favorite part that I actually still, that led me to the whole thing and that I still actually can remember, because so much of it I don't remember at all, but I could still remember this part. Are you ready?
Okay, lay it on us.
All right, here we go. This is the idea is that Peter Pettigrew has a son who's Piers Polkiss. Ready? Because I'm pretty positive Peter Pettigrew put a permanent pause on his paternal power. Basically, he found a woman to deflower, then ran like Snape facing a shower, which, sorry, Snape, didn't mean to throw shade, just trying to say anything to stop people from thinking about Peter getting laid.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.